Welcome to the U.S. National Privacy Legislation Podcast. This is Joy Mason-Intriago, Managing Director of the Association for Data and Cyber Governance. We are the only professional association that combines all aspects of data and cyber governance for the governance, risk, and compliance professional. You can find us online at adcg.org. It gives us great pleasure to host this event led by two outstanding moderators, Jerry Buckley and Jody Westby. Jerry is a founder of Buckley LLP, a national financial services law firm based in Washington, D.C. Prior to entering private practice, he served as minority staff director of the U.S. Senate Banking Committee. Jody is CEO of Global Cyber Risk LLC and chairs the American Bar Association's Privacy and Computer Crime Committee. We have some really great guests lined up today and in the future, so please be sure to rate us and subscribe so that you don't miss a single episode.
This is Jody Westby, CEO of Global Cyber Risk and Advisory Board Member for the Association of Data Cyber Governance, or known as ADCG. And I'm here with my fellow advisory board member, Jerry Buckley, who's founder and partner at the law firm Buckley LLP. Welcome to another segment of the ADCG U.S. National Privacy Legislation Podcast, examining the question of whether there will be an effort in the next Congress to establish national privacy legislation across the U.S. Today, we're joined by John Bowman, Senior Principal with Promontory Financial Group. John's located in the UK and can bring us an international perspective on privacy and data protection. There are surely lessons learned that we can benefit from what the EU member states have gone through in this area. So let's start with that. John, as the U.S. looks once again at the possibility of national privacy legislation, we hope that your prior experience as a policy official and civil servant in the Ministry of Justice in the UK, you served as head of the EU and data protection policy in that role, and we hope you can provide us some useful insights, especially in the area of preemption and private rights of action. We thought there were enough lessons learned from the EU that this could be a really useful conversation. Just to set the stage for our discussion, could you briefly discuss the path from the Data Protection Directive adopted in 1995 to the EU's adoption of the General Data Protection Regulation and kind of discuss the path that the EU took getting to this point?
Yes, thank you, Jody, and thank you, Jerry, as well for inviting me onto this podcast. It's certainly an interesting question, particularly in the context of potential developments in the United States on having a federal privacy law. I think the path from the 1995 Data Protection Directive, which the EU established back in 95, of course, to the General Data Protection Regulation, which was agreed in 2016 and effectively came into force in 2018, is an interesting one. We can actually trace data protection and privacy legislation in Europe back to 1981 when the Council of Europe Convention 108 was agreed. And indeed, that was the first legally binding data protection instrument which covered Europe. That Convention 108 was set at a very reasonably high level, but established some well-known principles which have sort of cascaded into subsequent legislation. And indeed, in the UK, the 1984 Data Protection Act was based on Convention 108. The European Union got involved in 95 with the issue of the directive. It's important to note that a directive in European legislative terms effectively sets a baseline and a minimum standard of legislation, which is generally then articulated and transposed into member state legislation. Now, this system, by the time GDPR came along, had been in operation for more than 20 years, and there was a sense that it led to fragmentation on the application of law. So more and more multinational companies were doing business across borders and processing data, personal data across borders, but they didn't have a coherent framework to work from. So there was almost a situation where they had to retain a law firm in every single country in the EU because each country had its own legislation which had to be adhered to. So one of the ideas behind the GDPR was to have a harmonizing directly applicable regulation. So regulation is different from a directive in that the law itself is directly applicable. So the idea is that you wouldn't need to have a law firm possibly in every single EU member state. If you knew one law, you knew it for everyone. So that was the intention behind the GDPR.
Let me just interrupt and ask a question of clarification. So the data protection directive then had to be translated into national law in every country. Mm-hmm. But in doing that, then it enabled them to have their own kind of data protection law, if you will, through that implementation in every country. So it was just a patchwork of 26 to 27 countries' laws.
Yes, eventually it became 27 countries' laws, right. But that's correct. It does end up being a patchwork. Now, there are common elements of the directive which had to be applied across the board, but there was more latitude for member states to design their own rules within that baseline framework. I think the idea behind GDPR was that more of the rules would be prescribed sort of preemptively in some ways rather than, from this original piece of legislation, GDPR, and therefore there would be more harmonization across the EU member states. But the other thing to bear in mind is that the EU's competence to legislate in this area, well, they had done previously under the directive, but it was confirmed in the sort of post-Lisbon Treaty era. So from about 2010 onwards, the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union actually set out clearly that, firstly, in the Charter of Fundamental Rights, the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights, every person in the European Union had the right to the protection of personal data. And because that is in the Charter of Fundamental Rights, effectively that gave the European Union competence to legislate in this area. Mm-hmm. So that was set out in Article 16 of the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union. So it was on that basis that the European Commission were able to issue a draft text of the GDPR back in 2012. At the time, there was a lot of discussion about whether everyone sort of knew it was coming, but there was a discussion about whether it would be a directive or regulation, and there are arguments for and against on both sides. But when it eventually became it was revealed to be a regulation, there was some kind of kickback from member states about this because there was an argument made that each country has a slightly different approach, national culture when it comes to data protection, and they should be given more latitude to define their own rules. But ultimately, those sort of pleas to have a directive were, sort of brushed aside, and a regulation is what it ended up being.
Well, that's very interesting. We have 50 states, and it looks like these lessons from all of that could be very useful in our discussion. I want to pass this to Jerry because I know that he got thoughts on this. Go ahead, Jerry.
Well, yes, and that was a very interesting and useful discussion and may well hold lessons for us in the United States. The GDPR did become enforceable on May 25th of 2018 after this effort, beginning in, actually promulgated in 2016 with time to get ready. And did having a harmonized privacy regulation work in delivering the desired outcomes of reducing confusion for participants, both on the consumer and the corporate side? And can the EU's path offer some lessons learned with respect to preemption here in the United States that we might be able to take note of?
I think broadly, the GDPR has been a success, and basically multinational organizations who have to apply this, across various jurisdictions, welcome the idea that there was a single regulation which would cover all those countries in the EU that they operated in. So I think it did help simplify those requirements. So the requirements to have a ROPA, the, under Article 30, the record of processing activities, the 72-hour breach notification requirements, the requirement to have a data protection officer in various circumstances. I think for those multinational companies that were applying the regulation, it meant that they could have one program to cover all their EU businesses or entities or undertakings. And that was important. The other interesting aspect of an innovative aspect of GDPR was the establishment of a one-stop shop. So in terms of their data controllers and data processors, even of the in terms of their regulatory interactions and relations, then it would be easier just to deal with a single data protection authority in one EU member state, and that effectively acted as an agent for all the others. So in theory, at least, I think all that was welcomed, and certainly businesses did appreciate the idea of having access to the EU regulatory system via their, what you might call their home or their lead authority, them being the sort of main contact point for their data protection regulatory interactions. So I think that's interesting. In terms of lessons learned and what the US could possibly learn from this exercise, well, in some ways, you could argue that the EU have actually pulled off quite a remarkable achievement here, because you have 27 different member states, or 28 when the UK was still in the EU, all independent sovereign countries, all with their own cultures, their own languages, and their own ways of doing things, and their own sort of historical legacies as well. And ultimately, despite the 4.5 years it took to agree this regulation, they agreed on a final text. Now, in theory, you would say that the component states of the United States of America are probably more aligned. They're all part of one country rather than separate independent countries. You do have common language generally, and there's other aspects as well, which where there might be, a sort of national approach and consensus which might be useful. You have national regulators, for example, in the form of the FTC, who have some oversight of privacy related compliance and so on. But at the same time, I'm not an expert on US sort of administration and government, but at the same time, the states do retain a lot more independence, and there's a lot more differences between them. And we can see that through the emergence of the state-based privacy laws, notably CCPA, but possibly others as well.
That is very, very helpful, and thank you. I wanted to ask very quickly, are there any rules around who can pick the one-stop shop, or where the one-stop shop must be?
Yeah,
purely up to the company to make that decision. They obviously have some presence, but do they have to have their principal presence, or is it something they can decide based on choice of forum?
Well, the way that the GDPR is set out is that the one-stop shop, so the designation of the main establishment, so the main establishment is, in GDPR terms, is where the main decisions regarding the processing of personal data are made, and effectively where that's normally going to be the sort of place of central administration as well. But it's normally a matter of fact as to where this is all done. The issue is, you can't, what the EU and the legislators wanted to avoid was effectively what they term as forum shopping. So the idea is that I might go to member state X, Y, or Z and say that I'm going to establish my data protection regime in this place because I think they are the softest touch country in terms of their regulatory regime and how they're Data Protection Authority operates. Now, they can't do that. And if there was a sense that this was happening, then the European Data Protection Board could actually consider the facts of where the main establishment is and determine what that main establishment should be. So it's not a question of forum shopping, but at the same time, there might be some companies who have, for other reasons, for investment purposes or for access to particular markets or access to particular talent, they may well have determined that they're going to locate themselves in a particular place, and they may well feel that that would be the logical country for them to have their as their EU main establishment for data protection purposes.
Thank you. I wanted to get that in there because there may be some thinking around that that would be relevant to our decision-making about preemption and the interaction between a state or states and the federal government in the United States. So what sorts of things do member states have flexibility on under GDPR?
Yes, so it's important to sort of look firstly at the GDPR itself, and there are certain elements in which it says that, you know, union or member state law may apply. So things like in determining the public interest legal basis for personal data processing. So those are, for example, in the UK, the Data Protection Act 2018 does sort of give a list of conditions upon which data controllers can process sensitive or special categories of data based on a significant public interest exemption. And those may include things like for insurance purposes, for artistic purposes, or journalism, for research, for preventing crime and serious crime and fraud and so on. So those are elements. There are also parts of the regulation which can be sort of further specified in member state law as well. Like, so for example, in Article 23 of the GDPR, this provides the opportunity for member states to place restrictions on certain elements of the GDPR, particularly in relation to data subject rights. And there's a long list of effectively exemptions which can be applied for national security, defense, public security purposes, the prevention, investigation, detection or prosecution or criminal offenses, other public interests, judicial independence and judicial proceedings, and so on. So, you know, an example of that might be where a bank or financial services institution is undertaking checks to prevent financial crime or fraud, and effectively they couldn't possibly give notice to an individual that their data are being processed, because in the UK and probably elsewhere, it is a criminal offence to tip off someone that they are under investigation.
Right.
So, you know, that's just an example of how those variations right. can be applied.
Let me ask you this. It doesn't appear that those permissions for local national variation have stood in the way of the efficiency of an overall national standard. So there are some areas that are carved out, but they haven't turned out to be so burdensome that companies haven't felt that they don't get the benefit of an international, of a European-wide regulation.
Yeah, I would agree with that, but there are certain elements where they would still need to be pay attention to the national law. So there is one sort of quite specific part of the GDPR regarding the processing of data for children under 16 in the context of the provision of information society services. So that would include things like social media or any kind of online interaction, digital stores and so on. And countries do vary that, because in the GDPR, the default is that for those kind of interactions, you would require the consent of a parent if the child is under 16. But the GDPR itself said that there was the ability for member states to change that, to lower that age to as low as 13. And indeed, some countries did. So the UK did lower the age where parental consent is required in the context of information society services from 16 to 13, whilst Ireland, by way of contrast, left that age at 16. So companies offering those kind of services to children would do have to adapt to the national context. And similarly, employment context, there's a lot more, I'd say, flexibility and diversity, I think, in terms of what's applicable. Labour laws tend to vary much more from country to country. Certainly in Germany, there's usually some sort of obligation to consult work councils before doing any sort of data processing involving employees of German companies. And, you know, from my experience, I've tended to find that German companies in particular tend to give a lot of consideration to things like data leakage prevention or employee surveillance in terms of having to consult with works councils. And really, the sense in countries like that is that surveillance has to be, you know, minimal or unintrusive, really. The other thing to mention is that the GDPR itself does not, although it provides for administrative sanctions, it does not specify criminal penalties. So what you do find in member states is that criminal penalties available, they're set out in member state law, and they do vary quite considerably, not only in terms of the offences, which can attract a criminal penalty, but the actual penalties available to the courts themselves.
That's what's always puzzled me, is variation on criminal sanctions. It would seem like that's something important enough. The GDPR would have said we're going to have one criminal standard for these violations, but I know that life isn't perfect, right?
I think the criminal justice systems just vary completely between countries. Yeah. And again, the criminal sanctions will reveal the differences between the countries, but I'm not even sure if the EU is even mandated under the treaties to provide for criminal penalties. I mean, certainly the GDPR sets out what the administrative sanctions are in terms of these 4% fines and so on. But actually, in the UK, if the case is serious enough to go to what they call the Crown Court, which is the higher tier court in the criminal justice system, then potentially a violation of the Data Protection Act and a criminal offence committed under them could bring about an unlimited fine.
Well, who does the GDPR apply to? Backing up, thinking about this, you said there are 27 member states plus now, I guess, the UK, who used to be part of it. But does it only apply to those? Or I think it extends to a few more countries, doesn't it?
Yeah, so, well, there's probably a couple of ways of tackling this question. Firstly, we might as well tackle UK, because I've mentioned UK a lot, and also it's the area I know most about. I can't really speak with much authority on the domestic regimes in other countries. But the UK is no longer a member of the EU. UK left the EU on the 31st of January earlier this year. But at the moment, the GDPR is still applies, because the transition period post-Brexit, so post the UK's exit from the applies up until the end of this year. So effectively, that transition period, status quo transition period, applies until the 31st of December. So at the moment, in UK law, the EU GDPR still applies. When the UK sort of exits the transition period, effectively, the UK is on its own from that point onwards. So the EU GDPR will no longer apply, but it will be replaced by something called the UK GDPR, which 95% of it is the same as the EU GDPR. What they've had to do is make some technical changes to the law. That's what they will do to accommodate the fact that the UK Data Protection Authority no longer participates in the European Data Protection Board, and that the European Commission, you know, no longer the rules of the European Commission, for example, in delivering secondary legislation like implementing and delegated acts, they no longer have any competence over UK law. And similarly, the UK no longer will fall within the jurisdiction of the Court of Justice of the European Union and the various appeal routes which apply. So probably the most significant sort of consequence of that is that the one-stop shop won't be available to UK data controllers anymore. So if effectively any UK data controller wants to take advantage of the one-stop shop or wants to have their binding corporate rules sort of reviewed in the EU context, they're going to have to find another regulator. So this brings us back to that point about who is your main establishment. Now, they're going to have to think about that because effectively to have a main establishment in the EU, they need to have an office in the EU which where data processing decisions are made. Now, we're aware of, I'm certainly aware of some companies who've designated France, Netherlands, Luxembourg, Ireland, Spain even as, well, not designated, but I've identified those countries as being what would be their main establishment in the EU, Germany as well, of course.
Yeah.
And I think in some ways, the European Data Protection Board have to show a bit of latitude in order to accept that those designations are valid and made in good faith.
Right, I think so. But are there data protection requirements in the EU that are specific to industry sectors, such as, you know, in the US, we have a lot of laws and regulations that apply to specific industry sectors, such as financial, healthcare, our utilities, defense companies. They have industry-specific data protection, or what we call privacy requirements. In the EU, are there any specific industry sector requirements?
Possibly. So GDPR is a, you know, effectively a sort of omnibus law, and it applies to everyone. The Law Enforcement Directive, which came out at exactly the same time and resembles the GDPR to some extent, applies to competent authorities involved in the prosecution, detection, prevention, investigation of crime. And therefore, the member state laws does a sort of transpose that directive into sort of national rules. So again, looking at UK, the Law Enforcement Directive sets out a lot of the rules which are similar to the GDPR in the UK Data Protection Act.
Do they have privacy requirements, data protection requirements?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. And that, so effectively, the Data Law Enforcement Directive, which was negotiated at exactly the same time as the GDPR, resembles the GDPR to a large extent, but applies to law enforcement agencies and offices, but is not a regulation because the European Union and European Commission recognized that, you know, it wasn't really for the EU to specify a general regulation in the context of law enforcement.
Yeah.
So that's in it. But in terms of other laws in the EU, there are lots of different laws which sort of touch upon data protection, and they may well vary some elements of the GDPR. So, I mean, there are laws in respect to things like passenger name records. So there's requirements for, you know, airlines to collect advanced passenger name information and passenger name records, which are then shared for, you know, crime and terrorism prevention purposes.
Yeah.
There's something called the Privacy Directive, which a lot of people will know because it was the one which brought in the famous cookie banners, which, yeah, you know, I'm sure everyone's seen thousands of. And elements of that law actually provide rules for telecommunications companies and right, how they sort of handle information. So, and there's even other laws which relate to things like, you know, in-car, you know, activation systems, if in the case of accidents and so on. So the GDPR is a kind of baseline horizontal law which applies across many situations, but there are more specific elements. But it's not the same as the US, where you have effectively a much more sectoral-based system.
Right. And our laws tend to apply to certain classes of people, such as consumers,
exactly,
medical patients, banking customers. And in the EU, that's really not the case, right? It's pretty much.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the reason for that is there is a fundamental right to the protection of personal data. There's actually two fundamental rights which come into play here. One is protection of personal data, which is in the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights, and that's under Article 8, and Article 7 of the Charter of Fundamental Rights refers to privacy and family life. And so they are taken as slightly different aspects, although thematically, and they are the same. But that fundamental right is universal. It's not, people just don't cherry pick bits of it, or it's not just applied in a fragmented way. Those fundamental rights are fundamental, and therefore the law has to reflect that. So that's why you don't get that specific consumer-based legislation.
Right. It's everybody, not just a consumer. One last quick question I'm going to throw in here. You have a requirement in the GDPR for every company to have a data protection officer. Is that right? And we don't have that here. We don't have any requirement that people have a chief privacy officer, for example. Mm-hmm. We're supposed to maybe have someone to manage things, but we aren't that specific. And what about the DPOs? Has that been a good requirement?
Yeah, well, the requirement isn't, you know, it doesn't apply 100% across the board, but generally, if you're a large organization processing large volumes of data, so any major corporation would require a data protection officer, and they have been appointed. A lot of the large companies do have data protection officers. They will meet the criteria where one is required.
They have to be over there, don't they?
They don't necessarily have to be over there. The EDPB guidelines do suggest that accessibility is a key criteria for appointing one. But, you know, if someone's on the other side of the world and they're happy to take calls at 3 o'clock in the morning in their role as DPO, then I guess that's not going to be an issue. So the law doesn't actually state their, that they have to be located in an EU member state.
So I know Jerry has 10 questions backed up here. So I'm going to hand this back to Jerry.
Oh, thank you. Fascinating. And I do have a quick question on the one following on Jody. Is there any specific privacy rule that relates to the financial services industry in the individual countries or?
Not specifically, but I think there are other rules which are kind of related, like the Payment Services Directive to money laundering directives and so on, which do have certain data protection requirements, which are sort of really, they do have GDPR as the baseline. But when financial services organizations are dealing with sensitive data and so on, then they have to be handled in the appropriate way.
That's very helpful. Now, with respect to enforcement of the GDPR, do the national DPAs have leeway in enforcement of violations of the regulation?
Yes. So effectively, the national DPAs are the enforcement bodies. And if a complaint is raised with them or they commence an investigation of their own volition, then they decide, within the basis of guidelines and the letter of the law, what's the appropriate sanction to apply if there's been an infringement of GDPR. But the one-stop shop and the consistency mechanism brings about is the idea that if a case has a cross-border interest, so complaints raised in several member states or data subjects in several member states have been affected, then effectively the national DPA, which is the lead authority, has to consult all the other what they call concerned supervisory authorities. And although the lead authority will prepare a draft decision on any case, that has to be shared with those concerned authorities. Now, the EDPB has a database which is publicly available of all the cases which have gone through a one-stop shop process where the lead authority has consulted and shared their draft decisions with other member states or concerned authorities. Now, the concerned authorities can sort of reject that draft decision. And if that is the case, then a kind of reconciliation process goes through, what they call the consistency mechanism. And effectively, they'll try and reach consensus based on, presumably the pleadings of the other regulatory authorities before the EDPB decides what the final sanction is. So generally, the member states do have a fair bit of autonomy, but where we have these cross-border cases, this is where the other authorities may want to have a say.
That's very interesting, John. You know, and I'm wondering if we have a short period, you know, 2 years, less than 2 years, really, that this has been in effect. Over time, I would imagine that some, if you will, I know the Europeans operate under the Napoleonic Code, but some common law of privacy will evolve through the enforcement process as the enforcement process takes place and there's precedent for how one situation is handled or another. There'll be more detailed understanding by participants in the marketplace of what is required, I would guess. I don't know, but I'm just guessing.
I can't really predict that because it's quite an unusual setup. And, you know, very few countries apply the common law in the EU. And obviously with the loss of the UK, I think there's only Ireland, Malta and Cyprus left who do apply a common law system. But at the same time, you know, the precedents will ultimately be set through referrals to the European, the Court of Justice of the European Union. So we've seen, obviously, the cases of the Privacy Shield and the Safe Harbor, where these European Commission adequacy decisions were ruled invalid following applications, these proceedings ended up in the CJEU and really that set the law.
Yes, and that as over time, I guess, there'll be more of that and the possibility of an amendment of GDPR as well. But what is the appeals process if a company disagrees with an enforcement action? Is there an appeal at the EU level? You're referencing that, but could you give a little more specificity about it?
Yeah, so, if this is where it gets complicated, and I did have to consult a book which I find incredibly useful called The Guide to the General Data Protection Regulation by Rosemary Jay, which I'd recommend to everyone. But generally, within the domestic context, I'm just going to talk about the UK. So please bear in mind that UK is no longer in the EU, but effectively still can act as a proxy for how things might work across the EU. But if an individual or an organization wants to appeal a administrative sanction which has been imposed by the Data Protection Authority, so the Information Commissioner's Office in this case, then they can do that through the court system. In the UK, the administrative court system, as any other administrative appeal would be, goes through a tribunal system, and the tribunals can, you know, amend the original ruling, they can dismiss it, they can change the order, and ultimately if these can be appealed further, I think on points of law, to what's known as the upper tribunal, ultimately they can go to the Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court in the UK. Now, there is a European way of doing this in that if there is a decision of the European Data Protection Board, so effectively one which has gone through this whole consistency mechanism process that I described earlier, then an application can be made for an annulment of that order, but that's in sort of relatively limited circumstances. So basically, it has to be addressed to the person involved and has to be of direct and individual concern to them as well. And generally, any sort of appeals through to the Court of Justice of the European Union will relate to things like where there's been a, there's lack of competence to deal with the case, an infringement of procedure, misuse of powers or some issue which has been brought up because of the legality of the acts intended to produce legal effects. So, the annulment procedure is quite a technical one and it will probably be less unusual that this route would be taken up on the basis that someone said, well, the fine's too high. And it's probably more about the procedure and the law rather than the merits of the case itself.
Well, you mentioned a couple of times EDPB or European Data Protection Board. What's the role of the EDPB? And I know they have some opinions and they issue guidance. And is that binding on member states?
the guidance, you know, by virtue of it being guidance, isn't binding, but the guidance is actually aimed at data controllers and data processors themselves. So, you know, effectively, it can be considered as part of the soft law and so on. So it's influential to that extent. But, you know, when it comes to letter of the law, then, you know, ultimately that's in the GDPR or through any, you know, national implementation of its various provisions. You know, I think the guidance is there to be helpful, you know, and actually guidance which is issued by the EDPB can effectively be challenged in the CJEU as well, I believe. But the, you know, generally most of the cases will probably end up being in the national courts unless the, you know, one or other of the member state data protection authorities actually object where that case has a cross-border significance. Yeah.
What about the state DPAs, the data protection authorities of the member states? Do they issue guidance too?
They do, actually, which does make it a bit confusing. You know, they do try and tailor guidance and for their own markets and possibly look at it more from a practical point of view. The EDPB guidelines, which have been issued, are quite lengthy and technical, and they go into a lot of depths. And, you know, by contrast, a lot of the member states, DPAs will have a website which is aimed, a lot of it's more aimed at, you know, small and medium enterprises who don't necessarily have, can deploy, you know, law firms to understand the regulation on their behalf, really. So, you know, I think to some extent having cross-European guidelines is helpful. And I think the national member states, you know, they won't do anything which contradicts those. They won't say anything that which does that. But at the same time, it's always worth checking both the European and the national guidelines if you're researching a particular issue.
Well, we're running out of time. In fact, we're probably over time, but this has been so interesting. And thank you so much for joining us this morning. I'm going to hand this back to my partner, Jerry Buckley, and let him have the last say and wrap up the podcast. But just thank you from myself, John, for doing this for us.
Thank you, Jody.
Well, there is so much more we could talk about, John. It's been very, very useful. And I also want to thank you. Learned a lot. I think that there are lessons in what you've told us that should be of great interest to our legislators here. They're trying to craft a system that would be across our nation, but have some respect for the individual states. And, you know, ultimately, I think we may be reaching across that vast pond to try to find a way to harmonize both GDPR and the whatever regime develops in the United States. If we are able to develop one, at least it would make for a better conversation if dealing with 50 different states, it seems. But anyway, thank you again. Really wonderful. And we look forward to further conversation.
Thanks for joining us this week on U.S. National Privacy Legislation. Make sure to visit our website, adcg.org, where you can subscribe to the show in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Overcast, Pocket Cast, or via RSS, so you'll never miss an episode. While you're at it, if you found value in what you heard today, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the podcast, that would help us out too. Also, you might want to subscribe to our weekly newsletter, Data and Cyber Governance Alert, which you can do right on our homepage. Be sure to tune in next week for our next episode, where we dig deeper into the possibilities of U.S. national privacy legislation.